Simmons or Sims. Can't make up his mind what his name is.
I'm going to go with Simmons this morning, Your Honor.
Okay, going to be Simmons this morning. This afternoon be Sims.
May it please the court, Brian Woodward on behalf of Mr. Simmons.
You haven't been fired yet, have you?
Well, if you read the sentencing transcript, you'll see that it was attempted. We were able to work things out. As Your Honors know, I'm in a rather precarious position this morning. That is, I filed a brief and a motion to withdraw simultaneously, citing Anders versus California, and received an order saying, no, you're staying in because you didn't tell us why these issues are frivolous. I attempted to do that in my reply brief, and we're still here for oral argument. So what I've done is I've gone through each and every argument the best that I could, researching all the case law, reading all the cases again, and in my opinion, the only plausible argument that I can make before this court
with a straight face
pertains to the right to counsel argument, the first issue in the brief, and that argument is spacious at best. So what I'd like to do is, and the first thing I'd like to note is, I cite Carlson versus Jess incorrectly in my brief. There's a typographical error. I refer to it as Carlton throughout. The T should have been an S, so it is Carlson, and I apologize for that. As we know, there's a presumption in favor of counsel of one's choice. That's from our Supreme Court, and that's based upon our Sixth Amendment and the right to assistance of counsel in one's defense. But we also know that that's not an absolute right, and the standard changes just a bit depending upon whether you're appointed counsel or retained counsel. You have a little bit more leeway with retained counsel in firing them, but not so much with appointed counsel. And this court, in prior decisions, has set forth three factors that the district court, as well as this court, will examine in determining whether or not a continuance should be granted and substitute counsel inserted in place of the counsel who's either been discharged or who is seeking to get out. And the first factor that this court has examined is the timeliness of the request. Now, as we know, this request was made on the morning of the jury trial, according to the transcript. However, that may not be entirely correct, because in the transcript, 10 days earlier, there was an arraignment on a superseding indictment. And at that arraignment, it appears that the issue of substitute counsel may have come up. If that were the only timing issue, because this court's already held, hey, 10 days, even that's not soon enough. I'm sorry. And I think that's cited in the U.S. versus, I guess it's Rails or Riles case that we've cited in our brief. This court's made clear that if we don't know when the fallout occurred between counsel and the defendant, we can't shift the burden necessarily upon the defendant for the untimeliness of the motion, because it may be the case that the fallout occurred days or weeks or even months before that, yet it was not brought to the attention of the trial court. So even though this was not raised until the day of trial, it doesn't seem quite fair that Mr. Simmons should be charged with untimeliness necessarily. And I think the history of this case sort of bears this out, because Mr. Holsinger was trial counsel initially appointed. He was replaced by Mr. Lambert for a short period of time as retained counsel, I believe. Mr. Lambert, I'm not sure, and the record's not clear, if he was discharged or if perhaps Mr. Simmons couldn't come up with the necessary funds to retain Mr. Lambert. For whatever reason, Mr. Holsinger was again appointed. Now, we know that after the trial, Mr. Holsinger again withdrew. I was put in his stead. For sentencing purposes, as you know from the sentencing transcript, let's just say that Mr. Simmons is irascible. I think is a good way to put it. He's not the best client in the world to get along with and to communicate with, but we do our best. And there is no indication. Oh, the other issue we want to look at as far as timeliness is concerned is there some administrative issue that comes to bear? That is the court's calendar so busy that they can't accommodate a resetting? And there's no indication in the record that that's the case. So, ostensibly, on the timeliness issue, Mr. Simmons is not necessarily foreclosed. The other inquiry that the court should make, or should make an inquiry into the matter, and Judge Simon is one of our finest jurists down there, and it's a pleasure practicing in front of him. But the Riles case says the inquiry should focus on why counsel cannot carry on, why a dispute exists, and if the breakdown can be fixed. I don't find that in the record, that specific inquiry. Judge Simon asked Mr. Simmons what it was that they weren't communicating about. He said he wasn't the indictment wasn't explained to him, the superseding indictment. There was apparently a fallout concerning witnesses to be named or not named on a witness list. Mr. Simmons didn't want any witnesses named because, in his opinion, there's no way they could aid his case. He did not want to see those people listed as witnesses. Judge Simon explained to him that, look, lawyers name all sorts of people as witnesses. That's common. You may not use them. You may not call any of them. Oftentimes, you know, the defendant brings no evidence to bear during their case in chief, and they rest on the deficiencies of the government.
Mr. Woodward, this
yes,
is
ma'am.
Going to sound very odd to you, but after reading the briefs and now listening to you, I'm still not sure whether we're considering this case as an Anders motion or if we're taking the appeal on its merits.
Well,
what are we doing here?
After I finished my argument, I was going to request on Mr. Simmons' behalf, because he's requested it of me, to ask you for reversal. At the same time, I was going to request once again that my appearance be withdrawn from any further proceedings in this matter, because after reading all of these issues, I am still not convinced under the facts in this record. Under examining these cases, I also looked at the confrontation issue and the videotapes, and I can't even get to a testimonial statement in the videotapes because questions aren't hearsay. They can't be statements of fact, so they can't be used against a person necessarily. Demands or requests, give me drugs. Demands aren't hearsay. They're not testimonial statements. They're not facts. Crawford versus Washington left open the issue as what they're going to define as testimonial, but the fact remains, and I looked at the confrontation issue because it's de novo review because of the constitutional issue, and I still can't get there.
Okay, so can you point us to any particular statement by Ms. Barnes on those videotapes that were prejudicial to Mr. Simmons? In other words, where the opportunity to confront her would have made a difference to the defense?
I certainly don't see how, because when you look at the video, they're relatively clear. The audio's relatively clear. You know, and when someone shows up multiple times, there are five separate deals, when they show up multiple times and say, I need this, which is demand. It's not a statement of fact. It's not, you're a drug dealer, you're a seller. Here's 20, or here's 50. And the guy sits there, and the audio is clear, cuts up whatever he's cutting up, wraps it in tinfoil, and she walks out the door. This is on video the whole time, with a grit task force police officer waiting outside monitoring. You know, perhaps counsel more astute than I could do something with that, but I'm not sure that I could. She obviously had reasons that he could have cross-examined her. There are reasons he could have, things he could have brought up, but I think he brought those up with the police officer. That is, you're cooperating, all the things you would normally do with a confidential informant. you're being paid for this, you're being let off the hook on this case, so forth and so on. But I'm not sure, so sure those things weren't brought out already through the police officer. So I could find no testimonial statements that confrontation would have made a difference in the trial. And at the end of the day, that's what Mr. Simmons has to prove. After you go through the syllogism, get to the bottom, you got to come to a conclusion. And is there a reasonable probability don't want to mix the issues. On the choice of counsel, is there a reasonable probability at the end of the day that the result would have been different, applying a Strickland standard? So,
okay, thank you very much, Mr. Woodward. And Mr. Bella, do you have anything you want to add? It's a little, not exactly an adversary proceeding, but...
Well, I hope to argue the case as ably as my colleague from Wisconsin a couple arguments ago. I would be happy to rest on the briefs, Your Honors. I, as to the request for appointment of counsel, the district court clearly engaged in the inquiry necessary, and there's no showing anywhere in the record that the counsel was ineffective. So I don't think that I would agree with Mr. Woodward that there really is no argument that could be made on the defendant's behalf. Ask the court to affirm the conviction and sentence.
Any questions?
Any questions?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Bella, and thank you.